Episode 9. We are back for more information on coffee tasting. Last time, 2 weeks ago, we talked about 5 different kinds of acidity commonly found in coffee and how those translate into tasting notes. And this time we're going to talk about origin countries or regions and how their particular environments often lend to kind of a similar taste profile from coffee to coffee within those regions. Not always, but generally speaking. We're going to talk in generalizations today. And we'll break the conversation up into
Central America, South America, Pacific, and Africa. And all these are really large regions, and so we're going to make some kind of sweeping generalizations just to kind of give you a glimpse of what you're looking for if you're just kind of, you end up at a coffee shop and you're like, what do I buy? What do I like? What am I looking for? Just some easy, quick tips.
Yeah, at the very least, it'll give you a jumping off point by which to compare certain coffees to what's generally typical. We'll start today with the region we probably buy the most coffee from, and that would be Central America. And Costa Rica and Guatemala tend to be the most popular countries in this region and tend to produce some of the highest quality coffee. But just generally speaking, Christian outlined some of the properties of the coffees from this region and then how that's reflected in tasting notes.
All right. So Central America, as Drew said, we buy a lot of Central American coffee and actually go and spend probably about a month down there every single year just because there's so many good producers to work with. They're fairly characteristic of being kind of a medium body coffee. They tend to feature kind of really sweet, nutty or caramely type bodies, and they tend to have kind of a citrusy acidity. Some of them can have more of an apple-like acidity. Citric and malic acidity back from the previous episode. What gives that general characteristic is two main things. One, there are only 2 primary varieties that are grown probably 70-80% of all this region, and that's Quechua and Quechuay, so 2 different varieties, but they compose probably 80% of all coffee grown in the region. And most of the coffee grown in the entire Central America is a wash process. This means that the skin is taken off the coffee cherry and the coffee is allowed to soak for about 12 to 24 hours, loosening up that mucilage, but it really develops a kind of clean, acidic flavor. So when we say the terms sweet, clean, and juicy when we're buying coffee, Central America is kind of the epitome of that.
It's easy to access too, which is another reason why we work so often with it. We can go down there and visit the farms, visit the producers, and really pick out with a high degree of certainty exactly the kind of coffee we're going to get. It's very reliable.
There is a bit of diversity there, and you can't really tell on the bag, but there's a lot of different types of soil, which will give you different cup profiles. Like, we have a really awesome coffee from Antigua, which is a very volcanic region. The West Valley is a very volcanic region. They tend to have similar characteristics. And you have some regions that are a little more clay-centric in the soil. They tend to have a little less acidity, a little more sweetness. Something else to pay attention to is that there's a lot of experimentation with processing. So when you're looking at the bag label, make sure you read what kind of processing is on there. If you have a semi-wash, if you have a honey process, if you have a natural, it's not going to be that same characteristic. It'll remind you maybe more of an African or a South American coffee.
African, then, what are we looking for out of that? How would that contrast or compare to, say, Central American?
Yeah, Africa is totally, I think it's the most exotic tasting coffee. It's where coffee originated, and there's so many different types and varieties and growing conditions and altitudes in Africa that every single region tastes kind of different. But you tend to notice these really wild and crazy fruit acidities there. Sometimes you get a little more phosphoric acidity. Ethiopia has a lot of phosphoric acidity. It kind of just lingers on your tongue. You can get some very tea-like notes in like a Yirgacheffe. And you can get some really exotic out there fruits in a Rwanda, a Burundi, or a Kenya. And it's kind of due to the processing styles that they use there. A little more complex than Central America coffees. Usually not the coffees I steer people to, like if they're just trying specialty coffee for the first time. Central America is way more accessible. I would say Africa is probably the next step to something a little more interesting and out there.
Yeah, I think a lot of experienced coffee pros tend to geek out around African coffee because they are more unique. They're looking for something a little bit different, and you can really get that with African coffees. I had a hard time sort of getting into Ethiopians for a while, and that was because of the Earl Grey tea-like bergamot-y flavors in a lot of Yirgacheffs. It wasn't until I really got into more light roast specialty coffee that I was anywhere close to enjoying a Yirgacheff. But generally speaking, baristas tend to have a good time whenever they see that name on the label. The other region you mentioned in contrast to Central America was South America, which with these other regions, it's difficult to just generalize, but maybe you can break it into two categories for us.
Yeah, that's true. I would say that kind of the north part is more similar to Central America than anything else, Colombia being the primary player from there. These coffees tend to be kind of bigger in body and have that really bright acidity that you might find in a Kenya or a really clean Central American coffee. But compare that to the biggest grower in the world, Brazil. And Brazil is just another beast altogether. Like, coffees from there are grown at a lower altitude. We're talking maybe 800 to 1,500 meters above sea level at highest. And so they don't develop the acidity, but they have a really sweet, kind of nutty-like body. And I find the better it gets, the less that nut kind of shows up and more kind of turns into a very mellow, like milk chocolate, dark chocolate flavor. So if you're looking for a lower acidity coffee, we usually recommend someone to go towards a Brazil. If you see a Colombia on the shelf, beware there's probably going to be a higher amount of acidity in there. And it's primarily tethered to the altitude. And all these regions kind of grow the same variety. They tend to grow Catura, Catuai, and Bourbon.
So Central and Northern South America is going to lend itself more towards the exotic specialty coffee. Also Africa, just on a whole different plane. And then Brazil maybe lends itself to more just your general mass-produced.
Brazil is a lot of mass-produced coffee. We do a lot of work to try to find coffees that are picked by hand or well taken care of, because it's really easy to buy a bad Brazil. It's really hard to find an amazing Brazil. And I'm getting nervous because I'm about to head on a 10-hour plane flight tomorrow to go to Brazil for the first time. Very excited to go down there and see what everything's about. It's a totally different flavor profile. We use it a lot in our espresso because it just gives us really amazing rich body, gives us nice dark color, and other coffees play well with it. I tend to not drink Brazils as much because I think they're very straightforward. Some of them just kind of taste like coffee to me, but I could see a lot of folks really enjoying a Brazil because of that really consistent characteristic.
All right. Then the last region, probably the most difficult to nail down. Certain parts of this region have a lot of name recognition, and there are some major fans of Sumatran coffee, New Guinea, and those exist within the...
So it includes Pacific, it includes Sumatra, it's Papua New Guinea. It also includes weird players like Vietnam, China, and India, which you don't normally associate with specialty coffee yet. They will be getting into the game probably the next 5 years. What really defines Sumatra is they tend to be like this really big body. And so if you like a really heavy body coffee, that's usually where I'd point you in that direction. However, a lot of Sumatras tend to not be clean. And by clean, what we mean is it kind of has an interesting, funky aftertaste that isn't natural to the coffee. It doesn't mean that it's bad, but it just means it's not something that I normally look for. It's partially due to the varieties grown in the area. And this is an overall sweeping statement, but it's not true in some areas of Papua New Guinea that grow really awesome things like Tipica and SL28, which you find in Africa. But the Catamores tend to lend this kind of earthy, greeny, almost green pepper flavor to the coffee. But when it's dark roasted, you get this just massive body off of it. We've also used this for our espresso in the past because it gives you that kind of interesting body flavor. And I know that a lot of people are really, really tethered to Sumatra, that you can't find that kind of flavor profile elsewhere in the world.
How much of it is tied to the wet hull process?
And so, to clarify that, wet hull means that the coffee is actually taken out of the skin, allowed to dry on patios, kind of in like a honey process. But what they do is they take it, they take off the parchment, and then they dry the coffee like on cement patios or on a mat next to the side of the road. I would say probably about half of that flavor is due to that interesting processing style, because you can have a fully washed version. We tasted someone. We're going to be working with Lisa and Leo Organic later this fall to bring in a really cool Sumatra. We tasted some of their honey process and their wash process Sumatras, and they don't taste like a normal Sumatra. It's because they take different care with the way that it's processed. It's not necessarily better, because that style has really become synonymous with the region. But it's not something, like, if I saw that happening in a Central America farm, like, no way I'm working with them. That's really weird. Are you meaning to get that coffee dirty? And by dirty, we mean stuff actually gets on top of coffee, or if you don't keep the coffee protected when you're drying it, it'll soak in whatever flavor you put on top of it. So if it's around dirt, your coffee's probably going to taste a little like dirt. If it's around petroleum, your coffee's going to taste like petroleum. All those are not things that I want in my coffee, but maybe other people like it.
Just generally speaking, too, I think when dealing with Sumatra wet holes, it's a general earthiness. It's kind of a way to put it. You may even call it burlap at times, depending on the age of the coffee or exactly how it was processed. But again, that sort of funk, and we even call it that, the Sumatra funk, does lend itself well to being a support in an espresso composition or blend.
Can we segue with We Got the Funk?
You're probably going to end up with a bit of a cleaner cup from someplace in Indonesia, like Papua New Guinea, if you get the right producer, compared to Sumatra. But I think a lot of people really dig that Sumatra because of that big body, and the flavor's reminiscent to what they kind of grew up drinking.
Especially in Milwaukee. A lot of the coffee shops in the area tend to be very Sumatra heavy. I don't know if it's a Midwest thing or if it's just a Milwaukee thing, but we got people that swear by Sumatra, and it confuses me because I'm like, dude, these coffees aren't clean. They're not... We even in the lab will say they don't taste good. Like, they're bad, and people love them, and it's just kind of confounding to me. But if you grew up with that kind of experience in coffee, of course you're going to go to things that you're familiar to.
All right, so four regions, Central America, where you're going to get kind of a mellow nuttiness. You're going to get a lot of malic acid with some citric acid, just nice clean fruit if it's from a really good producer, good chocolate notes. You move to South America, Brazil, you're going to have just real coffee-flavored coffee, for lack of a better way of putting it. A lot of nuttiness, some earthiness. You get a good producer, and you can end up with a clean, nice, juicy cup, which is what we're hoping Christian's going to track down for us here next week. Jump over to Africa, and you get real vibrant acidities, exotic fruits, and really exotic tasting notes related to tea, depending on the region of Africa you're dealing with. And then finally in Indonesia, due to processing and some of the variety, real big bodies, earthy coffees with some unique flavor notes tied to the particular region or the way that coffee was processed. Before we wrap up today, we're going to throw a little bonus at you and try and articulate for you how you can identify flaws or defects in coffee. Because sometimes we'll hear, well, coffee tastes like coffee, or people will even sort of make light of quality grading coffee. But when you get really experienced in coffee tasting, it's very easy to discern what a good coffee is versus what a bad coffee is.
Are we going to do a narrated live reading of the SEA coffee defect handbook? If so, I'm going to go run upstairs and grab it right now.
No, I want to keep it a little bit more simple and just kind of deal with things like over fermentation, which we talked a little bit about, so we can refer back to the previous episode, and old coffee, because those I think you see more than anything else.
Underripe you can taste pretty easily, and you can also taste over underroasted.
So let's start with over-fermentation, because we already talked about that. Just do a quick recap for us.
So, briefly, over-fermentation means your coffee tastes like balsamic vinegar. It adds this interesting fruity characteristic to it, and if you have a natural process, that's typically okay. If you have a wash process, you don't really want your coffee tasting like vinegar.
odds are pretty good. If you open up your bag and it smells like blueberries, your coffee's a natural process or it's over fermented. If it's a good natural process, you're going to drink it and it's going to taste really good. And then when you swallow, your mouth is going to taste pretty much normal. If you swallow and then it tastes like you just drank three tablespoons of cough medicine, you probably had an over-fermented coffee. All right, so let's move from over-fermented then to old. And when we say old, we're not talking about old roasted. If you have old roasted coffee, it's just going to be boring and flat. If you have old green coffee, it's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, old green coffee, the first thing you'll notice is that there's kind of a lack of acidity. It's kind of flat. The sweetness might have fell off a little bit, but what you start to notice is this really dry, almost cloying flavor on your tongue that if you went and licked a burlap bag, you kind of get that sensation on your tongue. And what happens is that the burlap kind of seeps into the green coffee and you get that kind of old flavor. We call it old. You can even get that flavor by putting coffee in GrainPro bags. And eventually, the coffee just starts to degrade. You start to lose that characteristic, and so you get like this papery, nutty, woody, burlappy flavor, which is not good. And if you're tasting that in coffee, odds are you're drinking a Sumatra or your coffee's old. The next is underripe.
Underripe is interesting and a little bit more difficult to pick out than old coffee. And it's actually predominantly present in sort of the aftertaste. After you swallow,
yeah.
It impacts your tongue in a unique way.
Yeah, it's like drinking burnt popcorn towards the finish. Like flowery, floral, burnt popcorn, which is a kind of a terrible example. But if I've done cuppings where I've put underripes in a bowl and had them taste side by side with good coffee. And it's really surprising. And once you taste it, by itself, you notice it in coffee altogether. I notice underripes the most in natural process because it's super hard to sort them out.
Mm.
But you can find some in some lower quality regular coffee. It's also pretty common in Brazil's, again, because they're kind of doing a natural or pulp natural method, not as good as sorting. And what's interesting is you can actually see underripes in the roasted coffee. If your coffee is roasted to a light level or a medium level, they'll appear as really, really light tan beans that don't match the rest of the beans in the bag. And if you were to pull that out and kind of chew on it, you get just this. It's not pleasant, but I recommend you try it once and then wash it down with some really good coffee afterwards. But it's an intense experience. And what happens is the coffee is not ripened to the proper level. There aren't these acids and sugars inside the coffee bean. The roaster can't roast those acids and sugars because they're not there. And you get this weird, awkward tasting bean.
And I was just thinking through this. These light tan beans, we often call them Quakers. And they just don't roast to the level that the rest of the coffee roasts. So when you look at a single origin, like single farm coffee, you'll end up seeing different shades of roast from bean to bean because these beans aren't able to roast to the level that a fully ripened bean is. And that doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Like, why can't an underripe bean be roasted to the same level that a ripe bean can, a ripe cherry?
If you think about how a fruit develops, like it goes from the stage of being a flower to a bud, and then it changes from this green bud to a yellow bud to a red bud, and that's kind of signaling the maturation of sugars and acidity. If you pick a coffee bean or coffee cherry off a tree before it's fully ripe, it doesn't have the potential materials in order to change the color. In order for coffee to turn brown in the roaster, like a nice deep dark brown, you need a high sugar concentration, you need a high acidity concentration. You can burn it and turn it to carbon, but it won't change to that brown color unless there's enough components of the Maillard reaction to take place. And it's kind of an interesting question because not a lot of people think about that in terms of, they think brown coffee means just burnt coffee or carbon coffee, but really it's a set of complex enzymatic reactions that we won't get into this episode, but I think is terribly interesting. It's the same reason why your meat turns brown when you sear it on a pan, or your vegetables sear when you put it on a hot pan. It's not due to the temperature, it's due to the enzymatic reactions and chemicals taking place underneath, inside of the food.
One of the biggest defects we see when we bring coffees in from other roasters to cup, and I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, so I won't, but we see a lot of coffees, especially from specialty coffee roasters, as under-roasted. A lot of companies do over-roasting. It's charcoal turned into beverage. And I think most of us are familiar with that. So we'll just focus on this under-roasting, which really is a shame because a lot of specialty coffee roasters start out with really nice beans, but you can only go downhill when you get it into your hands. You can either sort of bring out the best that that bean has to offer, or you can jack it up. And I'm afraid due to sort of the fad of light roasting, a lot of the times it's jacked up. And so when we talk about under-roasting, Christian, what are we talking about?
So when we're talking about under-roasting, we're talking about coffee beans that haven't spent enough time in the roaster. So the best analogy I can think of when you're trying to describe undercooked or under-roasted beans would be baking a cake. So you put a cake in a fixed environment, you have it at a set temperature, and you need to leave it in there until the middle is done. I know, just watching a lot of cooking shows, a common mistake with cakes or brownies is that you take the cake out too late and it gets tough in the middle. But you also don't want it to be gooey and raw on the inside either. You need it to be at that perfect level where the structure of the cake has made it such that it's delicious. When you're under roasting a coffee bean, what happens is you don't leave the coffee in the roaster for long enough, and you get these really intense acidities, which is why people do it. So the flavor tends to be kind of underwhelming. I find it kind of grainy, cereally sometimes. And it's just, you don't unlock the potential of the coffee. And when I started roasting initially, like, I was really drawn to that because it was so different than the baked coffee I'd had, which is a completely different characteristic. But what I'm learning is that you need something that has balance. You're always looking for a balance of all these different flavors. If you just focus on the light portion, you're going to alienate a bunch of your customer base, but you're also not going to unlock all the flavors in the coffee.
So with an under-roasted coffee, what are some of the flavor notes you would get, or what kind of impact does that leave on the mouth that you wouldn't get if the coffee had gotten the roast it deserved?
So I think you notice a lot of, like, really piquant acidity.
And that would be what?
Just very sharp acidity, like very, very crisp acidity. You get a little bit of this, like, green, grassy characteristic. I think it's due to kind of a higher concentration of chlorogenic, and stuff hasn't broken down into good flavors yet. You tend to notice kind of this sweet, cereal, bready. It's hard to describe, but if I brewed it for you, you'd know it right away. There's also a lack of body in most of these coffees, and what's weird is that you can go to a roaster that has super light roasted coffees, and I can almost guarantee it doesn't matter where they source it from, they're all going to taste the same.
So we're going to wrap our conversation on tasting notes there. Sort of, now we've talked about acidity, we've talked about how different regions of the world sort of have different flavor profiles that you can expect, and we've talked about defects and what often shows up when you have coffee that's either not handled well in processing or picking or even the roasting. Next time we're gonna actually deviate a little bit from our norm. We tend to try and share some of the brewing or roasting or scientific expertise that we may have acquired just in our careers here at Stone Creek and working with coffee. But we really want to just kind of share a little bit of our perspective on coffee culture. Like, coffee culture is a weird thing, and it means different things to different people. And there's, I would say, a lot of different coffee cultures. But it's a unique, almost sociological conversation to have. It's a bizarre phenomenon that started thousands of years ago and has evolved quite a bit.
We're just having a dialogue on what coffee community means, and does it have a place in the normal consumer's brain? Like, the person who's buying a Folgers, do they care about coffee community? Because our baristas, and I think you and I, Drew, both care a lot about coffee community and building and creating this really cool atmosphere. But the questions come up a lot is, like, do customers really care about being part of the coffee community, and who is the coffee community in service to? So that's kind of what we're going to explore next time, which I think is a unique topic and a unique conversation.
In the meantime, jump on iTunes and leave us a review if you would be so kind. You can also email us, podcast@stonecreekcoffee.com, and let us know what you want us to talk about. Even if you just have a very simple question, you can email us, and I promise we will answer your email because we're awesome. Till next time, we are geeks.
And we are talking coffee.
Per usual.